Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. I'm Alex Andreu, and with me, speaking for the new elite, I have Hannah Fearn. Good morning, Hannah. How are you?
Good morning. Up and early. It's okay. I don't mind these early ones.
Are you feeling elite-y enough today to guide our listeners through the news?
That is something I never feel, but hopefully I'll come bring some elite understanding. Boom, boom.
Right, Hannah. The Great Prigozhin Rebellion, let's start with that. It ended as quickly and suddenly as it started. What is our best guess on what happened?
Well, it's interesting. Everyone's calling it a potential coup, but some of the language around that, I think we have to be very careful about, because its aims were very unclear. But what we know is that after months of tensions and pushback over attempts from Putin to absorb Prigozhin's private military group, the Wagner Group, into the Russian army, he seems to have sort of snapped and turned his men against Putin, who he's been a long ally of. He's obviously been responsible for doing a lot of Putin's dirty work all over the globe. They were a large force in Syria. They've been a really important part in the Ukraine offensive. And Prigozhin's lost 20,000 men in Bakhmut, he says. It's a huge number. So the aims are unclear, but the group did manage to take control, if not full ownership, of Rostov-on-Don, which is a very important southern Russian city close to the Ukrainian border. And they began a march up to Moscow, which Prigozhin called the March on Freedom. And when they were about 125 miles from Moscow, obviously this is the first time we've seen anything like this against Putin's leadership in decades, a compromise agreement was made. And now Prigozhin was able to remain a free man, despite essentially making some attempt on, if not on power, then on destabilizing Putin. And he's been able to leave for Belarus, and his soldiers have been able to return to their previous posts. And as I said, they're obviously doing their job, essentially propping up the Ukraine invasion. So what happens next is an interesting period, really, for the whole of Europe and global stability.
Now, it's easy with all that soap opera to forget sort of the real situation in Ukraine. Mm. Will this episode have a major impact on the Ukraine campaign?
It's interesting. Experts are saying it's too early to tell. But because it's the first major challenge, and it's from, you know, a leader who's been an ally of Putin for so long, a military leader, but whose significance in Ukraine has been huge. The relatively limited success Russia has had in key battles in the Donbass region has been down to this group. So it must leave, I think, Ukrainian morale at a real high and Russian troops feeling very directionless, and that will be important. Mm. Well, in fact, when he left Rostov-on-Don after this deal was brokered, he was cheered, which really shows the size of the issue for Putin. This isn't just about military discord. It's about humiliation and, you know, discord of an order I think a lot of us assumed wasn't possible. So it must leave Ukraine very buoyed, I think.
Putin's image has been undoubtedly dented with the troops, as you were saying, because they were sort of observing all of this going on in real time.
Mm, yeah.
But is his control of the Russian media so complete that nothing penetrates the wider public sphere? Or was this noticed by, you know, ordinary Russians on the ground, as it were?
Well, ordinary Russians in Moscow had to be told to stay indoors. There was a lockdown of sorts because of the risk of, you know, a full military action in the centre of the capital. So they can't have failed to notice that. How it's been spun, of course, yeah, is a different thing. Generally, the spirit is very pro-Russia inside Rostov. And so the fact that he was cheered shows, I think, that despite the intense control, as you describe, over the mainstream media, that the mask is slipping, really. And if people stop fearing Putin, both the military and the people, I mean, what else does he have left, I think?
Yes, I think it's fundamental for Putin to be synonymous with Mother Russia.
Yes.
If those two things at any point diverge, it could be an interesting time. What is next for Prigozhin, do you think? Polonium tea and cakes? I mean, Putin doesn't have a record of forgiveness, does he?
People who cross Putin, as we know, have a habit of dying in unexpected and brutal circumstances. Mm. He's not necessarily safe because he's in Belarus. But interestingly, experts also aren't expecting him to go there and have a nice, quiet retirement either. Putin has accused him of, in his words, betrayal and treason, and yeah. described it as a stab in the back of our troops and the people of Russia. So we can imagine that he might be planning some sort of unfortunate sort of window dropping incident, but he is expected to still make noise. So that shows a certain, I suppose, commitment to demonstrating the failures in Putin's regime now.
Now, I also heard a tiny bit of gossip, some analysts discussing on Sky, that there is intelligence that President Xi Jinping of China was also involved in brokering a deal between Putin and Prigozhin. How would you read that?
I think, as you say, this is only sort of a few rumours at the moment, and there's no kind of clear reporting demonstrating that is the case. But let's say for this moment it is correct. I would say that that's all about propping up Russia as an ally and not really about Putin himself. I don't think it shows a great confidence in Putin. Mm. And the situation in Ukraine has narrowed Russia's options for cooperation globally. So China can now really put the pressure on, essentially. They haven't got any other options. So China knows that they can manipulate Russia. And getting involved in this would be a very handy way of owing big, essentially. So
yes,
that's what I'd say if that turns out to be correct. But we'll see.
I mean, it was serious intelligence analysts putting forward this,
yes,
this
I think
idea. And to me, it feels like, I mean, if anything, China basically said, if there's going to be a change of leadership, sunshine, it ain't going to be you.
Yes.
And, you know, they want someone basically in place that will at the very least honour the various agreements and various obligations that they have forced on Putin.
Someone that they, yes, feel is equally manipulable, but I don't think that he's clearly not that figure. I mean, let's not forget that one of the experts said, and I thought this was really interesting, that Prigozhin was a disaster waiting to happen for Putin. And inevitably, if you essentially use illegal tactics to fight illegal wars, if you pay people to do your dirty work, this is the kind of individual that you're going to get. He's not part of an institution that represents any government. He happens to have an allyship to Putin, but that's it. And of course, Xi Jinping won't want to get involved in that kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting times in the Chinese sense. Now, on to domestic skip fires. Rishi Sunak over the weekend has asked people to hold their nerve on interest rates. Hannah, can the problem for mortgage holders who might suddenly be asked to pay 50% more be solved by a plucky attitude?
I should think not. Also, who's holding their nerve here? Is it us or him? Because he's the one who came in and promised action on all of these various things. The top one was interest rates and inflation. That was his big, big promise. And now he's telling us to hold our nerve. Well, I think sunshine, he should look at himself.
Might he be talking to the back benches of his party, actually?
Indeed. Or looking in the mirror and being very concerned, reflecting his own fears back. But it's interesting because, as some commentators already said over the weekend, this isn't actually, I'm not making an original point, lots of conservatives are going to be looking at what's happening with interest rates now and wondering why they even bothered to get rid of Truss. Because the result is exactly the same. And although obviously it's ludicrous, there are some people, a significant minority within the Conservative Party as it stands now, who think that, you know, we should have just felt the pain to commit to Truss's fiscal plan. So we're feeling the pain and then we don't have the plan. I mean, thank God from my perspective, but there we are. They must be worried about that.
Yes. And the point is that the situation with trust wasn't flattening out, it was spinning out of control, which ended up with the bank having to issue gilts to calm down markets, which has an inflationary effect.
Yes.
At a point when they need to be restricting the supply of money, they were beginning to issue gilts in order to calm the markets, which would have the exactly opposite effect. So I, you know, I think trust fans have earned themselves a longer period of silence.
Yes,
than
exactly
they seem
that. Yes, yes. But it doesn't mean they won't be agitating, though, for, you know, in the back benches for Sunak. So Hunt's big ideas around mortgages, which were introduced as a result, really, of, you know, this panic that Sunak is having, they are too small to tackle the problem. And all they do, so the three things that he introduced last week were...
So just for our listeners, he called in the big lenders, they had a big meeting last week, and some action points came out.
Yes, and the three things that have come out of that are the lenders have agreed to do some things which help homeowners in the short term if they're really feeling the pain and they can't repay. So first of all, they've introduced an agreement that they will prevent your home from being repossessed for 12 months if you can't pay in the short term. So it gives you that window of opportunity to sort things out financially for yourselves. They also would agree to consider to extend mortgages if that would help ameliorate the situation, or allow customers to switch to an interest-only agreement for a period of time, which obviously eases the monthly burden. But none of this actually makes anything easier on the consumer in the long term, and particularly mortgage extension. Everybody in that meeting will fully understand the current mortgage market because they're experts. But what makes me fear that this entire package is simply about how people feel, how the electorate feels, and not actually about the financial health of homeowners, is that it ignores the fact, which all these experts would know, is that extremely long mortgages are already very common. So 30-year repayment terms are now absolutely the norm for first-time buyers. 35 and 40 years are becoming very common. We're already lending regularly up to age 70, and some lenders will now lend to age 75. So if you extend that mortgage, what exactly are you doing? You're extending it into late retirement. It's really not a proper solution. But what is unsaid about all of this, and people forget, it's very easy to forget if you're one of the millions of people with a mortgage right now feeling worried, is that the majority of homeowners in Britain, I think it's around 60%, I'd have to double check, own without a mortgage. So most homeowners do not have a mortgage. And so this is reflecting what people want to hear, particularly if they're Conservative voters and it doesn't actually affect them. For those who are already sitting on a 35-term mortgage, being told to extend it is not a solution.
The other point that I have rarely heard over the last 10 days is that in precisely the reverse situations, 15 years ago, basically the public were told to bear the burden of banks doing badly.
Absolutely.
In the financial crisis, and you know, the state basically had to underwrite all those loans. But now we seem to be going cap in hand to those same institutions and saying, is there anything you can do about it? I think solidarity must go both ways. Sunak also says we need to hold our nerve on NHS waiting lists, promising a sort of jam tomorrow, trademark Ross Taylor, staffing plan. But waiting lists are at record levels. Junior doctors and consultants have more strikes coming up in the immediate future. We're expecting a result of a nurses' ballot this week on more strikes. I mean, will this even make a dent before the election? Or is it basically a teenager just shouting, all right, Mum, I'm doing it from their bedroom?
Yes, it's too late, I think. It's too late to see any real action. Turning around an institution of the size of the NHS with the level of investment necessary, it's a long, long-term project. And even Starmer's team are going to be worried about whether they can make any dent in it in 4 to 5 years. So yeah. I think, yeah, it's definitely jam tomorrow, as you said. But this is another one where I think he's missed the mood of the country in talking about holding your nerve, because the people are fully behind the doctors and nurses and their strikes. They are desperate for the surgery that they've been waiting a long time for and that the pandemic forced them to wait longer for. And actually, comparing it to the mortgage crisis and inflation, this hits far more people than the mortgage crisis for that exactly that reason that I said. Most homeowners don't have a mortgage. You know, a lot of people rent. Everybody has some engagement with the NHS, and most families have at least one person who they know is waiting for something. There are now 7 million people on the waiting list. It's a huge number. So, yes, I think he's really missed the mood on this one. And this is the one that will undo the Conservatives at the general election, and partly because they linked it so closely to Brexit. So that's their own fault in the pro-Brexit campaign.
I remember those videos of how wonderful the NHS was going to be post-Brexit. And another related development, suddenly, apparently, the recommendations of peer review bodies are not sacred, they're mere suggestions. can the government really get away with such blatant double standards after a year of saying at every interview that they wouldn't pay people properly because they were following peer review body recommendations?
Well, exactly. And additionally, do you think we should remind them that the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority, or IPSA, is an independent pay review body? And essentially, yes. You know, none of them have ever come out to say that they think IPSA is wrong and that they should hand back some of their salary to the public purse. So, yeah, it's not just a suggestion. No, these review bodies are carrying out a careful consideration that reflects a huge amount of expertise and understanding of those professions. And the language of suggestion is so dismissive of that work as a starting point. That language is the indicator to me. It's like you can just take and leave what you want because you know you're gone soon anyway. I think that's it. It's refusing to make any commitments because it's all over.
The gap between the Tories and Labour is reopening in the opinion polls. I mean, this is no longer a few polls here and there. There is a movement that's reflected across almost every single one. Some polls are now putting the Labour lead at over 20 points again, 22 points I saw over the weekend. Now, we have between 3 and 5 by-elections coming up, probably 5. Note for listeners, Doris has now officially missed the deadline to be included in the same round of by-elections before the summer break. So
what a farce.
I know. But we think we do have 5 of them coming up. Can the result in those 5 by-elections be so catastrophic that it forces Sunak or his party to action of some sort, an early election, a rebellion, I don't know.
I think an early election is unlikely. Unfortunately, I think it is going to be a slow fizzle out. These by-elections will be instructive, and I think they will be pretty devastating, although perhaps not quite by the 20-point margin that the national polls show.
Well, they're not that kind of seat, actually.
Exactly.
Only one of them is that kind of
seat. It might be tempting to look for those kind of overwhelming switches, but it won't be that. It'll be much more closely fought. And I suppose the question we're left with, if it is a slow run-up, is Starmer a better sprinter or marathon runner? Because we're going to find out. And I'm not entirely sure I want to know the answer, because at the moment, what's driving this 20-point lead for Labour is almost all Conservative cock-up. And there are going to have to be some Labour wins now in the next few months. We need to see it. So, you know, we're not the other guys might get Starmer over the line, but it doesn't actually foster that kind of goodwill and positivity that means things really get done in government. There tends to be, if you think of the big...
It doesn't generate a mandate.
Right, exactly, that's the word.
Because mandate. Starmer doesn't just need to win the election. He doesn't just need to get into government. He needs a mandate with people behind, you know, a slate of policies, and we don't really have that yet, although there are some policies beginning to emerge. Now, Labour seem to vex a lot of its people by announcing an all-male all-white list of candidates for those possible five by-elections. Mm. Was this an unfortunate fluke? Is there a big underlying problem?
I think it's a bit of both. So I think it probably is an unfortunate fluke because you can only stand the people who want to stand in those areas. And one of the reasons we never have enough women to stand in any of these areas is partly because of the nature of the underlying problem. And I just bring up the example of Stella Creasy. I know it was a while ago now, but it sticks in my mind. There was an absolute outcry when she brought her baby. He was completely silent. He was about 3 months old and she couldn't leave, breastfed baby, into the chamber because the rules meant she couldn't actually have any proper maternity cover. So in order to actually represent her constituents on a very significant debate and vote, she had to come in. So, I mean, of course, that's not attractive, not just to, I think, younger women, but women in midlife and older who just don't want to be seen propping up those kind of structures. So I think it's an issue. And until that is sorted out.
Especially when it seems to be based on nothing other than a sort of, you know, middle-aged men's fear of a boob.
That's exactly what it is. Or, oh, good Lord, what if we hear a tiny cry before someone ushers the baby out? I can't possibly cope with that. I mean, honestly, it frustrates me beyond belief. But it's that culture. People don't stand because they can't be bothered to get involved with all of that. And I fully understand the reasons for it.
No, this is a lovely segue to look at the week ahead in Westminster briefly. It looks to be a relatively quiet one in the Commons, although nowadays who knows what will happen by Tuesday. But it's an interesting one in the increasingly exciting House of Lords. What's going on?
Well, this is really interesting. So we've got issues like national security have been going back and forth to the House of Lords. We've now got the migration bill coming back. And the House of Lords are basically a voice of sanity in this. The only people who seem to think it's right to take a moral pause and really think about the implications of that bill. And thank God for that, because it's so shocking. You know, the question is, do we think that they are becoming emboldened, I suppose, by Sunak's failures and the Home Office failures, not just Sunak, the whole administration.
And but his weak mandate, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I think the House of Lords would have a different attitude to a government that sort of feels like it is popular out there in the country, led by the person that actually got them to victory. I think all of this feels like the lower chamber is kind of unelected at the moment as well. So they might as well have a go at them.
Yeah, well, I do think there's a lot of that, but I also think there's some of the impact is the kind of the other way round. Because their integrity exposes his weakness and that makes him weaker. So it's not just that they're emboldened by his lack of power, strength and control over his own government and the country. It's also that they are showing some genuine moral integrity and it exposes just how vacuous the government is, that it doesn't actually have any moral core at the moment, certainly on issues around migration and immigration. It's phenomenal, really, that we are turning to what you might have historically considered the most conservative chamber in the West, in the Western democracy, and it's become borderline radical. But thank goodness.
Now, back home in Greece, we had our second election in a month, and as much as I would enjoy making you pronounce all the names, would you like me to tell you
about tell me about this one.
It's not good. Basically, the New Democracy, the equivalent of the Tories here, had a massive victory, despite really having been plagued by some major scandals in the last year, including wiretapping phones of high-ranking officials, of politicians, of opposition politicians, of even their own ministers, despite that awful train crash which revealed a huge problem with security on our public transport. They have basically increased their majority. They've secured 158 MPs out of 300, which is actually a bit of a landslide in Greece. We tend to get coalitions. It's very rare to get an absolute majority. Syriza, the left-wing party, its vote has pretty much collapsed. I think there are real questions about its leader, Alexis Tsipras's future. So that will be decided, I imagine, in a general synod of the party's instruments in the next few days. And most worrying of all, there's the re-emergence of the far right. Three far right parties of different flavors, between them have about 12% of the vote. It's not a massive amount, but you know, considering Greece's brush with the far right a few years ago, it is worrying.
I read that one of those parties was born almost directly out of the banning of Golden Dawn. Is that right?
Yes, it has the backing of the unofficial sort of remaining leader of Golden Dawn. I mean, personally, I find another one of those three even more worrying. It's called, so the party you refer to is called the Spartans. The party I'm referring to is Elliniki Lysi, which is Greek Solution, which is basically a party of Greek Orthodox priests.
Gosh.
I mean, proper religious, theocratic situation. So, yeah, not great. I mean, at the very least, I would say that the right-wing party that has been elected is technocratic. But it's just worrying that there is disarray to the left of it now, and beginning to re-emerge challenges to the right of it. Because New Democracy is already pretty right-wing, and the notion of it being dragged further to the right is really quite a worrying one. Absolutely. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. What else? The four big supermarkets are in front of the Commons Business Select Committee on Tuesday, so greedflation will come up again.
Let's hope they actually talk about Brexit there, hey? Because they seem to shy away from that.
Will they, like banks, just be asked to play nicer, I wonder? What else? Did you enjoy Johnson's latest scintillating male masterpiece at around $20,000 per column? Does it seem like good value?
Titanically predictable rant, you might say. So he was writing about the Titanic sub-explorers, their sad demise. It was rant at lefties, in inverted commas, when actually he was just making an obvious point about this being, you know, a kind of a heroic endeavour and how sad that it ended like this. I mean, of course, he's a great writer. Okay, look, as a journalist, yes, I think he does turn out a pretty good quality column. But the problem
I have to disagree. I thought his prose has been shit in the last two columns, actually. I would encourage people to go and have a look at them.
So maybe we're comparing against different things. Okay, I used to be comment editor of The Independent, and let me tell you, a lot of what came in, even from some quite significant names, needed a lot of work. But I would say that the thing is, he's not saying anything interesting or useful to the Mail. They're spending a huge amount of money on him, but he's basically just another Jan Moyer now. Why is he writing about these things? People surely want to hear insider stuff from him, or something that you feel like you can't read from anybody else. But while he, you know, we may debate whether it's good writing or not, he's simply churning out what any, you know, reasonably good quality national columnist should be able to do. Why are we paying him for that? I have no idea.
He's just marking time, I think, Hannah, because it will be either two or three columns that they've agreed will be sort of on unrelated, anodyne subjects. And I think either next week or the week after that, yes, he will start firing into Sunak's government. I get that sense. I said it actually before even his first one came out. I said it will be two or three completely anodyne columns, and then he will turn his fire onto the government. Anyway,
let's watch.
Yeah. Finally, in comedy news, Kemi Badenoch has ordered an investigation into the entirely confected cat pupil story. Do you even want to comment on it?
I do, because I think this is depressingly clever move. Obviously, it's mental. So, of course, no one's identifying as a cat. And if Ofsted find anything in this school, the only thing they're going to find is potentially some children with special educational needs, maybe autism spectrum disorders, who essentially are having positive compensations so that they can be equal in school. And don't forget, equality is not the same as equity. And equity is what you should look for in school so that everyone has an equal chance to succeed. And that is the sort of thing that ends up with these nonsense stories about identifying as a cat. But she knows what she's doing because I'm afraid to tell you I've been on Mumsnet. Actually, I don't like the way that site is always is labelled as, you know, transphobic and this, that and the other, because it's just a bunch of women sharing their experiences. And inevitably, that means that the site represents the great diversity of female experience and opinion in the UK. I can tell you from looking at that site that a lot of women with secondary age children do believe what they're reading about this and are very worried about it. And that is why she's been clever to send this Ofsted inspector in, because this is a headline that will do really well for her, even though it's nonsense. And I find depressing. That utterly depressing, but there
utterly
we are.
Utterly depressing. And that's it for today.
I'll leave you on that positive note.
leaving you that depressing note, I anoint you fully prepared to start your week. If you enjoyed it, remember to tune in for another Bunker tomorrow. And you can support our getting up at 6 a.m. to do this for as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to you for listening to Start Your Week. Have a good one.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Start Your Week with The Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreu and Hannah Fearn. The producer was Liam Tate, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.